Good evening, this is Calvin Hammond in Studio 4 from the front line. Today I will be interviewing my father, Peter Hammond, on a specific topic of the dangers, difficulties, and disasters that can be part and parcel of missions to the persecuted church and in restricted access areas. Dad, what exactly can go wrong on a mission field?
Well, this particular week is 25 years since probably one of the most disastrous series of events that ever took place in our mission's history, and our mission's been going 38 years. Back in November 1994, we sent four mission teams, four vehicles into the field, and only one vehicle came back. And one of our frontline fellowship field workers, Anthony Duncan, was killed in the course of that mission. And this was all part of a very complex series of missions to five countries. And Anthony was returning from a very long, difficult, dangerous mission to five countries. He had been part of a frontline mission team that had successfully delivered desperately needed medicines and Bibles into war-torn Angola, communist Angola. There was a shoot-on-site policy, United Nations blockade on UNITA-controlled free Angola, and our frontline mission team had succeeded in delivering a ton of desperately needed medicines and Bibles to the suffering Christians in Angola. And the mission team was on the way back from this eventful trip, which had also included one of our vehicles rolling down embankments and crushing its canopy on the way up to Zambia. Back in those days, the so-called Golden Highway, which you've traveled on in Caprivi Strip, but by the time I took you along there in 2008, it was tarred, but back in 1994, it was just one long dirt strip. And clouds of dust would just hang over this dirt road. If there was no wind, which frequently there was no wind at all, you just had these clouds of dust, and so your visibility was very restricted. And suddenly they saw a vehicle coming straight for them and had to yank the steering wheel, left the road and rolled. So that
the road that they were on, was it just a single...
It's a single strip. Okay. Well, vaguely, but I mean, being a dirt road, there was no dotted lines or anything. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they had this truck heading towards them, so these things happen. There's a lot of vehicles crashed on the Golden Highway in old days before Germany built this beautiful, almost freeway down there. That's there now on the Shesheki Bridge, but that's something else. So on this mission, Anthony had already gone all the way up, done mission to Zimbabwe, mission to Zambia. Then he had gone to join our team in Namibia, old Southwest Africa, smuggled in the Bibles and books into Angola, gotten through the lines. It was very serious. 1994, it was still hot war going on in Angola. And on the way out, they'd succeeded in delivering everything. On the way out, they got ambushed by PLAN, that's People's Liberation Army of Namibia, SWAPO Army, so-called Namibia. And they machine-gunned up the vehicle. Our people were captured. They were imprisoned. And I was leading one of the teams up in Zambia. We were running a biblical worldview seminar up in Lusaka, and I got a message to phone our mission office urgently. Now, you may not think that's complicated, but in Zambia at the time, of course, we didn't have cell phones, we didn't have satellite phones, we had no remote way of... So we had to find someone who had a telephone. And I went to, for example, to the national broadcast, Zambia National Broadcast. I had a radio interview there. And so I asked them, could I make a phone call? And said, sorry, we have no phones working. This is Zambia's national broadcast. The director of Zambian TV and radio was there. He had no telephone because they'd cut them off for non-payment to the national telephone provider. So I had to rush around town to find somebody who had a telephone, to phone Cape Town, to learn that our team was arrested and imprisoned on the border of Namibia for breaching the blockade, smuggling in medicines. Well, I didn't know what they'd smuggled in, into Angola. They were just therefore crossing the border illegally, breaking the blockade. And so I had to rush around while running a seminar to get pressure mobilized. We didn't have one field worker or staff member back in our mission in Cape Town. Everyone was in the field. That was normal. November, December, we were all in the field. We had a few volunteers. These are people who just came in for a couple of months, been to one or two of our camps. So a shame. We had a couple of twins who were running our office. I think they were just 19 years old. And next thing, they've got this crisis and they're trying to get hold of me. And course, that's way before emails or anything else like that. And so we were just having to get a phone call here and there, and of course the lines weren't as good. But by God's grace, some of the people I'd been in prison with, such as General Godfrey Mianda, who was at that stage Minister of Education in Zambia, he was hosting peace talks between the Angolan government, the UNISA Freedom Fighters of Angola, and the Zambians were being the mediators. So I was able to get word from old prison buddy to intervene for us, and he said to the Angolan representative, "You see that these missionaries are released, or this negotiation goes no further." And they said, "But they're not in our hands, they're in the hands of Namibia." I said, "It doesn't matter. They're your friends. See that they're released." And after just a few days in excruciating, disgusting, disease-ridden conditions, our team was released.
Do you think there could have been a higher purpose or a bigger reason or bigger picture that they were captured and that they were able to be released during this conference?
Oh, there's no doubt that God's timing. And I mean, these are friends I made in 1987 when I was captured and arrested and put in prison, Lusaka Central Prison. And how was I to know that the future governor of Zambia, including people like General Godfrey Mianda, were in the same prison cell? And I was in a presidential detainee cell under Kenneth Kaunda's orders, presidential detainee, which means you're detained without trial, without charge, and without hope, actually. And that was another story how I got out of that one. As the whole mission unfolded, the bad news just kept coming in. You know, one of our teams had rolled on the Golden Highway, crushed the canopy. This is the rainy season. They've got all the literature in the back of the buggy. The canopy's finished. It's this old fiberglass canopy. And they're trying to keep things dry. And, of course, it's all kinds of rain coming. That's what goes on November, December. And next thing I hear about this team being arrested and imprisoned and their vehicles written off. And so I had the only working vehicle left at that stage, it seemed. And so I had to negotiate through, after our mission Zambia, through to Namibia to pick up the survivors. And it was, in fact, while this was going on, that Anthony, who was another vehicle, he was heading down back to South Africa, and he had this head-on collision. Now, after all of the experience of being part of the team that smuggled barbs in, you could just imagine we were reeling. It was like one, two, three, wham. You're getting punched on the left, punched on the right, and now an uppercut to the jaw. And you can imagine our poor volunteers back at home in Cape Town trying to coordinate things, and us having to work out, well, who do we know in the general area who can go and help our wounded team person, and, of course, deal with the different funeral arrangements and getting the body back to Cape Town. The vehicle was written off, smashed to pieces, mangled beyond comprehension, head-on collision with a speeding vehicle overtaking a long truck, mist of the morning. It was so extraordinary what all the things that went wrong on this mission. And my father-in-law, Reverend Bill Bathurst, put together this whole incredible story in Angola by the back door. The team, the trip, the trouble, and the eventual tragedy. And all sorts of stories came out after this, as we realized. I mean, you know, what can go wrong on a mission? Well, vehicle accidents. Do you know more missionaries die from vehicle accidents than any other source? And, of course, diseases come shortly after that. There was one mission. I remember I just joined Hospital Christian Fellowship on my very first mission, and we learned that the entire Operation Mobilization team in Sudan, from the team leader, the entire team, all of their contacts and so on, this restricted access area, had died in a vehicle accident. The combi had gone off the road in a mountain pass. Everyone killed. They'd lost everything. It was in a restricted access area. You don't have files. You don't have contacts. Everything's in your head and memory. And so with the death of that team was the death of the entire work for years in that part of the Middle East, the 1040 window. So this was actually not very long after that incredible series of events. So it was the mission where we sent four vehicles into the field and only one came back. But then we started to hear all sorts of extraordinary things, like Anthony Duncan was a remarkable Christian. People said he had more lives than a cat. When he was in the army, he had survived contacts with terrorists. When he was a game ranger, he had been part of the elite anti-poaching unit. He had tracked down these poachers who were armed with AK-47 assault rifles, automatic weapons, and he's got a bolt action. And he beat them with his bolt action rifle, and they've got these automatic weapons. He was on a rhino rescue operation, and we've got the picture of him after. You can see him all full of mud on the wall there. He got trampled into the mud by a waterhole by the rhino while he's trying to grapple his rhino and get him in for a relocation project to rescue rhinos. And another time, he was being chased by an elephant and he reversed fast up a road to escape a charging elephant and almost bumped into a herd of elephants right behind him. And he was in deep trouble of being crushed by these elephants who were angry. And on another occasion, Anthony was being charged by two lions. And although he had a revolver and he had a rifle, he, like me, as an animal lover, and he couldn't bring himself to shoot a magnificent lion. So he put down his rifle and he threw rocks at these lions to deflect their attack. And can you imagine the
nerve?
Yes, that you've got to stand calm and throw rocks. And he did deflect their attack, and he lived to see another day. Once he came off his 1100cc motorbike at over 160 kilometers an hour. That's over 100 miles an hour. He came off into a mealie patch and stood up and walked away. He did seem to have nine lives, and he was only 29. Anthony said, you know, he spoke like he was going home soon. He said, I'm not going to make 30. He was pretty sure he wouldn't live to 30. And he was a cheerful, enthusiastic Christian. He could fit all of his possessions into his backpack. He owned nothing more than what fit in his backpack, because whatever he had, he seemed to give away. He was a very generous chap, a zealous evangelist, very patient, compassionate counselor, very spiritually minded. I'd hope we're all ready to go to heaven, but he was actually eager. And interestingly enough, I didn't know this at the time, because as the team, the mission leader, I would often guide, especially new teams, experienced teams, I let them make their own choice of routes and so on. But on this occasion, these were new, inexperienced missionaries. And he was meant to go up the N7 and then the A1 through Namibia, up that way. And then I at the last minute switched things, put him on a team that was going first to Zimbabwe, to do a Zimbabwe mission and a Zambia mission, and then join the team in Namibia later. What I didn't know is his parents were divorced. They lived up in the Joburg, Pretoria area. And his brother and his sister were not walking with the Lord, nor were his parents at the time. And so Anthony, because I sent him up the N1 and instead the N7, sent him through Pretoria to get to Zimbabwe first, he had the opportunity to speak to his family and his brother and sister, and he challenged them about their relationship with the Lord. And I only know this because at his funeral in Cape Town, they each testified to how Anthony, the last time they'd seen him, how he had challenged them straight about their walk with the Lord and being right with God. And there were a lot of tears and a lot of people who came right with God over this, just realizing life is short and it's uncertain and you just don't know. And so here's a person who literally everything he owned could fit in a backpack. And here's the other thing that's amazing. Just on his last night alive, he was in the Tosha Game Reserve, where you've been with me. And he has converted to Christ by another game ranger in Atosha after his time in the army. And so as he had a chance after this arrest and all the drama of the mission to Angola, he went up this mountain where he had come to the Lord and he prayed all night. He came down and everything he owned had been stolen out the back of the bucky, because this was the bucky that had rolled and didn't have a canopy. And so he literally had only what he was standing in. Even his, he had his Bible, because they'd taken it up there, but everything else, his backpack, everything was gone. He didn't have a spare pair of boots. He died with his boots on, but he left nothing behind. And I mean, this just reminds one again that you cannot take it with you, but you can send it on ahead if you sow your treasures in heaven, where your treasures, there your heart is. Well, he had invested in people's lives, and there are people alive today in Angola because of him. And he died without a possession in the world except what he was wearing.
Do you think outsiders listening to this type of story, and do you think people hearing his death at such a young age after he could accomplish so much more. Do you think there was a reason for that, why the Lord decided to take him early?
There must be a reason. We don't understand the reason. But I saw lots of people's lives impacted by his testimony, his life and his death. It's hard. I mean, the Bible says, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of the saints. And it's a hard thing. It was tough. I must say it was one of the hardest things I've had to do in the mission as a mission leader, to phone the parents, hear the mother screaming on the other side of the phone, the weeping and the, and you know, speaking with the, both the father, the mother, the brother, the sisters, it was, you can imagine, to be the bearer of bad news is horrible. And to take that funeral was, again, one of the hardest experiences as a mission director ever, because I believe in leading from the front and leading by example. And it's one thing to be willing to sacrifice your life for the Lord. It's another to have someone else. And of course, there's a great sense of responsibility. I mean, I sent him on this mission. I even chose this route. And it was hard, but we do believe all things work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And Anthony loved God, and he is called according to God's purpose. And so I hope that even now, 25 years later, his testimony will touch people's lives to invest their lives in eternity. You only have one life. It'll soon be passed. Only what's done for Jesus Christ will last.
And then what advice would you give to those who are looking to venture into the mission fields? I know that there's, specifically with African ministry, there's a whole perspective that you're going into lion territory and you're sleeping with giraffes and you're going to be attacked by people in animal skins with spears and such. But what are the actual realities and what are the ways that we can prepare?
Well, we should be prepared. And I'm afraid that a lot of people come to the field unprepared. And yet the mission field can be dangerous. A lot of things happen. We had a Salvation Army major from Australia murdered in Malawi just a few years ago. Things happen. We had a mission team here in this very mission coming from a well-known big mission wanting us to prep them for Zimbabwe, and I was giving all prep and instruction and warnings. And I remember one of the people sitting in the back saying, but why are you telling us all this? You know, God will protect us. And I said, well, he expects us to use our common sense and to be prepared. And I said, no, well, Lord's led us. We don't need to worry now. I said, no, this is a very dangerous mission field. And we warned them about Zimbabwe. And I could see these people getting irritated and a bit exasperated over warnings and you know, things that you need to be watch out for. They crossed the border in the combi, the same combi that came here to this mission. And they crossed the border on the way. They just entered Zimbabwe and along came a car hooting and waving, a normal civilian car, and they stopped, and a person jumped out and said, he's a policeman. Now, he wasn't wearing police uniform, but, and he said, pulled the door open, pulled the keys out of the ignition, command everyone out of the vehicle, all got out of the vehicle. The man and his accomplices got in the vehicle, hijacked it, drove away, and left him standing. They lost their Bibles, their cell phones, their kit, everything, the vehicle, the mission vehicle, everything they'd come with, gone. And they just knew what they're standing on the side of the road. And this wasn't a police vehicle. Nobody was wearing a police uniform. They stopped in the middle of nowhere because someone was waving them down and telling them to stop. And we'd been warning them against just this sort of thing. And the entire mission was finished.
And why do you think things like this happen?
Well, the Lord warned us. He told us to be as wise as serpents. He told us to be alert, to do not be deceived. There's a lot of warnings in the Bible not to be deceived. And the scripture tells us to be prepared. A prudent man sees danger and takes refuge, but the simple keep going and suffer for it. Proverbs 22, verse 3. In Ecclesiastes 9:12, we read, moreover, no man knows when his hour will come. As fish are caught in a cruel net or birds are taken in a snare, so men are trapped by evil times that fall unexpectedly upon them. So we are warned to be prepared. I mean, it wasn't raining when Noah started to build the ark, but he and his family survived the flood by building the ark and stocking it in obedience to God. And there's a lot in the Bible to warn us about practical preparations. And you can even see the practical, thoughtful preparations made. I believe every missionary going in the field should be well prepared. And I mean practically prepared, not just prepared in the sense of knowing the Bible, which is, of course, vital, and understanding the geography, which is very helpful, and the culture the people are going to, that's very helpful too. Understand the religious worldviews of the group you're going to go to. But there's a lot of practical things too, just bushcraft and survival and the laws in the land and the situation and understanding reality. I've been ambushed. I've been rocketed. I've come under artillery bombardment. I've been bombed by high-flying Antonov bombers. Our teams have been strafed by low-flying helicopter gunships. We have been arrested. I've been imprisoned. I've been in prison multiple times, including in Zambia and Zimbabwe and Mozambique, and captured up in Sudan, and threatened several times. I've been put against the wall and told, you know, we're going to shoot you, firing squad, getting ready kind of things. Generally discovered later it was a tactic to try and extract information out of us, but could have easily happened. And time and again, well, everything from scorpion bites, injuries, vehicle accidents, floods, storms. One of our missionary teams was up in Sudan and pitched their tent and parked their vehicle in the middle of a dry riverbed. And, you know, there was no rain, but there must have been somewhere up country, because a flash flood carried them along in the night. Suddenly, vehicle lost. Everything washed away. They were in a dry riverbed in a place where it never seems to rain, but somewhere it had rained and that water came down, the flash flood. We've had someone else drive a brand new vehicle into a river to cross it, and the river took this vehicle and filled this vehicle, and the vehicle was stuck in the river for 3 days before they managed to get it out. And pickpockets, bag snatchers, we've had people robbed on as they've crossed the border. It's amazing amounts of things that go on. So people need to be prepared, and that's why we actually organized the Great Commission course, to train people practically in what to expect and learn from the people who've been there. We need to understand what we're getting ourselves into, and that's why I wrote the book Security and Survival Handbook, especially to prepare missionaries for how to survive in the field, how to be effective in missions without becoming a victim is just one of the chapters, and the case studies that we look at, and how to prepare for these things. I do think it's faith, common sense, and a responsibility goes together. Basically, it goes like this. You do everything you can, and you trust God to do what you cannot. Some things are in our power to do. You know, for example, the farmer can plow the field, scatter the corn, do the irrigation. There's a whole lot of things he can do, but he can't send the rain. He can't make the seed to grow. I mean, God sends the sun, God makes the seed to grow, God sends the rain. There's things you can do, and there are things only God can do.
But then looking at situations where you have the deaths of fellow field workers, either on the mission or off the mission, whether they're young or old, the natural human reaction is to weep, to ponder, and often you stop in your tracks with what you're trying to do, and you think, okay, should we continue with this mission or this activity or this plan? What is the biblical advice or instruction to deal with such situations if you lose the loved one, especially if it's for a reason that makes no sense, or the person is young? Or
yes, Dr. James Dobson wrote an excellent book, When God Doesn't Make Sense. And of course, we can't possibly understand everything involved in the complexities of these issues, and what incredible sacrifices were made. Just recently, I was learning about missionaries who responded to David Livingstone's call to go to the Mokolo people at Linyati, that's up in the Chobe area in northern Botswana, southern Namibia, just off the Caprivi. And these missionaries, whole families with children, went there. And so they'd read Livingstone's travels, heard him speaking, and after his first mission journey, while Livingstone was busy with a second missionary journey to the Zambezi expedition, they went up there. It took them a year to get there. They get there with a family, or ox carts, and so on, broken axles, oxen dying from tsetse flies, malaria, all sorts of things. They get there. And when they arrived to these people who had asked for these missionaries to come, they were responding to challenges that had come through David Livingstone. They arrived in this place, but now the old chief had issued the invitation to die, and it was a new chief who didn't trust or like the missionaries, and he poisoned them to death. Virtually everyone died, the children, the wives, the men. One man and two children escaped when they realized what's going on. That's mainly because they hadn't eaten the meat, which was poisoned. And everything stung. And the disasters, and you can imagine, David Livingstone came there and he found this entire two sets of families, large families that had come there, wiped out. Poisoned by the very tribe who had begged for the missionaries to come there. And all of their possessions stolen. And you can imagine things like that are devastating. And I, as a mission leader who's trained and sent people into the field and, of course, gone myself for 38 years into restricted access areas, there have been many a time I've been absolutely in agony of heart and mind over the risks. And that's why I've often been the one who's gone myself to test and check that first before I take anyone else in. I've done most of my missions on my own, and seldom have I ever had a mission team go into a field that I hadn't first researched, pioneered, and opened up. It is hard, but studying the Bible, first of all, Christ Jesus suffered for us and left us an example that we should follow in his footsteps. Studying examples of missionaries in history, people like Apostle Paul, who was stoned, shipwrecked, beaten, flogged, and all of that. Studying recent missionary history, what people like David Livingstone, Mary Slessor, C.T. Studd went through, William Carey, these poor missionary families up in Linyati, you get an idea that this is a war. It's a spiritual war. It's a war for people's souls. We cannot expect to win a war without casualties and without sacrifices. And obviously, we want to be careful. I don't believe in being reckless. But we do take calculated risks. We are working, after all, in restricted access areas, focusing on persecuted churches, war zones in many cases. And so naturally, the risks are higher than normal fields. But there's risks in every field. And yes, it's hard to do. But from Bible study and study of history and contemporary missions, I do believe that we can and must take some calculated risks. Bear this in mind. A lot of people die for no reason at all. Car accidents, crime, and so on. But they're not risking their life for any major goal, but they're casualties. Isn't it more meaningful to suffer for advancing the kingdom of God and serving the persecuted church?
And then looking onto those who are on the sidelines, as it were, how can we pray for missionaries? How can we better raise up a new generation or help fund, tithe for, or prepare people in our areas or in our local churches to go into the mission fields?
I think every church should be a missionary sending agency. Every family should be an intercessory base for missionaries. It's been a wonderful experience of mine to be hosted by different families, sometimes farmers and home educators and so on. And you can see they've got up on the fridge and on their notice boards pictures of different missionaries, maps of the world, our family's pictures sometimes too, prayer letters. They're going through Operation World. They're praying for different countries. They're praying for different missions. They're working through different prayer letters. It's super important to know you've got the support and you've got the prayer backing. And this is spiritual warfare. The people who've woken up at strange times praying for missionaries, not knowing what's going on. And they found it months or even years later what was going on at that very moment, which is extraordinary. So we need to be informed. We need to be interceding. We need to be involved. Getting on the mailing list of the newsletters, we send out our regular Frontline Fellowship e-updates. People can just write to mission@frontline.org.za, mission@frontline.org.za, and get on our email list. They can go on our website, www.frontlinemissionsa.org, and see the different reports and even prayer lists they can download. Just to give a good insight, if you could see and screen the film Missions to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. Now, there's a short 13-minute film. It's been put together by Christopher and Hunter and Razan.
That film was very recently made, wasn't it?
Very recently. Just uploaded in the last month. So that's something to specifically design because it's short. You can show it in a church, you can show it in a home cell group, in a school, but to give people a feel, and it's an historic film because it's showing you the delivery of the largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled to an officially Islamic country. And I had the record for many years. I delivered 9,700 Bibles and New Testaments back in 1998, the largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled into officially an Islamic country, and that was back in 98, and that record held for a long time. But that was broken last year by Hunter, Ben, John, and Aubrey's team. They delivered 100,000 Bibles and books into the New Mounts, of which 40,000 were full Bibles. And this year they broke it again with 125,000 Bibles and books into the New Mounts of Sudan.
Yes, and for those who are wanting to watch it, just know that it's relevant and it's
very
recently just happened. It's not an old black and white movie from the old missionaries of the past times. It's current, it's relevant, and if you feel that you want to pray for it, it's ongoing. It's not a potential plan. It's something that's happening currently and changing lives at this present moment.
Yes, and the mission's not over yet. That's why it's called Missions to the New Mountains of Sudan. So you can get that on the Frontline Mission SA.org website. It's right up front. You can click on it. It's on our Vimeo channel too. But if you see that, it's not just what's happened over the last 2 years, but it's what's going to be happening over the next several years. It's an ongoing series of missions providing Bibles as textbooks for schools. They got to 260 schools in Sudan, so it's quite extraordinary. And of course, it's risky. And I must say, having my daughter's son, the father of my grandsons, going into the Nub Mountains last year, I was really nervous, praying. It was difficult. And my wife, your mom, was saying to me, now, what is your problem? It's not like you haven't been there in worse times with when the war was hotter and all this. I never saw you worrying about your missions. It's different. It's one thing when you take a risk for yourself, but when others are taking a risk, I wasn't with them. And I knew there were three fathers going up there. Aubrey, John, Hunter, children, wives.
Young children, come, young families.
Very young families. And I felt the danger immensely. And I must say, I think I sweated and prayed and feared more over that than the 27 missions I've taken to Sudan myself over the years. And it just shows again that as a mission leader, it's easier to do it yourself than to send someone else out to do the same. So yes, it's important to know and to understand and to pray. And let me tell you, missionaries are very encouraged by notes, whether it's on social media or on email or Christmas card or whatever, just letting them know they're not alone, they're not forgotten. It means a lot. And yes, support. Faith missionaries need support.
Yes, on that note, where can we listen and learn more about these missions that are going to happen and for the missionaries who are needing funding or support or prayer?
Yes, so if you go on the frontlinemissionsa.org website, we've got our prayer and praise updates. We've also got Pray for the Missionaries. We've got prayer posters that you can download and put up at your school, like Pray for the New Mounts, Pray for Zimbabwe, Pray for the Middle East, Pray for the 1040 window for the Muslim world, Pray for South Sudan. So we've got prayer posters that you can download, print, post, share, social media, or literally put on the notice board at your church or school or homeschool. And for us to get people motivated and informed, Operation World is always tremendous to learn more about every country. But choose a mission, choose a missionary, choose a missionary family, project or country, and have your family focus their interest, their support and donations to be able to get. It means so much more when it's personal, when you're investing in a family that you've got to know, or a church project that you know, or a mission that you particularly trust and has track record in the area. So yes, we can all do something. We need to be informed, we need to be involved, we need to be interceding and investing. There's obviously printing Bibles cost money, fuel costs money, and then there's all sorts of ancillary things like anti-malarial tablets and what happens when you get sick. And so sending teams in the field, generally speaking, our teams don't even have enough funds to complete their mission. And you know, it's one thing to go in faith and trust the Lord for miraculous provision, but it's a lot less strain on the person when they've got all the equipment they need, the medicines they need, and contingency needs. Mm.
And for those who may feel that they're not ready to go into the mission field yet, we have a bit of a more local one. We have the upcoming Biblical Worldview Summit and Great Commission course, which will be happening from the 3rd to the 9th of January in our Mana campsite in Hermanus. And then after that will be the
Great Commission course. Yes, so if a person wants a taste of missions, think, you know, is this, even if you're not wanting to go in the field, but you want to understand it better, to pray for it better, getting involved in the Great Commission courses, like a crash course in missions, cross-cultural missions and evangelism. It's very practical and it's short-term outreaches. So a person gets a chance to go on almost daily out and doing some evangelism, all sorts of evangelistic opportunities. And of course, it's a great way to get fit and lose weight too, because there's mountain climbing, there's this PT, there's practicals, there's team building, obstacle crossing, problem solving. And everyone who comes on a Great Commission course gets to conclude after 3 weeks of building up their strength, they climb Table Mountain. And we don't just climb Table Mountain in the daytime. We descend it at night. We see the sunset from top of Table Mountain. We have a Sermon on the Mount type of praise and worship on top of the mountain.
Yes, and if you think you're not great. Going to be challenged enough, we'll be having night hikes every second or third night, where you'll be doing espionage practices and you'll be carrying literature and you will learn how to cross rivers without making sounds and how to avoid other teams. It'll be very practical if you think you'll be within your comfort zone. You're very, very wrong.
Of course, when you say espionage, you mean covert Bible smuggling operations into restricted access areas. And so we have hunter teams and we have smuggling teams. And often somebody like Calvin, who's been a scout, who's been going through these areas for most of his life, when he's on the hunter team, you're in trouble because he knows the areas well. But, you know, we can learn how to outwit. And so this is the thing. These Great Commission courses help prepare one. And one of the textbooks Great Commission course participants take away is the Security and Survival Handbook. And it's so important to learn from those who have been in the field before. And we've got some great books here, you know, learning from missionaries to Eastern Europe, like Bill Bathman, Going Through, Going On, and his Angola by the Back Door. My books on Faith and Defiance, Sudan, and the Killing Fields of Mozambique, Holocaust and Rwanda, some of my fields. And learning from these people like Mary Slessor and David Livingston, I think that's what helps prepare us, learning from examples of excellence.
Dr. Hammond, thank you for your time. And for those who are listening, if any of this information regarding the camp and course coming up, if it intrigued you, please get onto our websites. Please apply to come on the camp or the course. Everything that we have spoken about here will be dealt with in detail as well as practically. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
God bless. Good night.